of ExxonMobil, and that would be James Quinn.
Good morning.
David Lender, both from the Weil Gotshal firm, and Andrew Paulus from the Moser firm in Cleveland. With the court's permission, Mr. Quinn will argue on behalf of ExxonMobil.
Right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Sparks.
Good morning, Your Honors. Before we start, I'd like to introduce out-of-state counsel with me at the council table, Mr. Kenneth Adamo, Gregory Castanius, and Lawrence Rosenberg, all of the Jones Day firm. And with the court's permission, I will be making the argument on behalf of our client, Sovic. As Your Honors are aware from the briefing, this is an appeal from a $416.8 million jury verdict. Just so we have the parties straight, it is based upon the claims of an Exxon subsidiary, ECAI, and a mobile subsidiary, Yanbu, that beginning in 1980, and for 20 years thereafter, Sovic breached cost pass-through provisions in two joint venture agreements by, according to the claim that they made, secretly charging the joint ventures a margin upon certain Union Carbide technology licensed by Sovic to the two joint ventures, Kenya and Yanpet. We submit that this was the product of, first, a critical threshold legal error in which the trial court wrote the statute of limitations, the Delaware statute of limitations, out of the case, followed by a cascading series of material errors in the content and application of Saudi law, and capped off by the trial court simply throwing up its hands and passing to the jury a $324 million enhanced damages issue, notwithstanding the trial court's expressed views, which Your Honors can see in the last two of the post-trial rulings attached to our opening brief, that it could not with confidence either define the tort upon which the damages were based or the standards to be applied in determining whether such an award was appropriate. Now, I'm prepared to answer any questions the court might have from the briefs, but what I have planned to do is focus on four of the errors. One is the three-year statute of limitations issue, a matter of law. The second is the trial court's order as a discovery sanction prohibiting testimony from Sovic's chief negotiator stating he had personally informed ExxonMobil in 1980 about Sovic's intent to charge a margin. Third are the erroneous rulings and instructions on the Saudi tort of Ghasb. I'm going to do my best to pronounce that. It's spelled G-H-A-S-B, but it's the Arabic is approximately Ghasb. And that opened the door to an enhanced damage award of $324 million above and beyond the $92 million erroneously awarded on the and finally, the fourth point I'd like to touch on is the trial court's refusal to grant judgment as a matter of law in our favor or to permit the jury even to consider the implications upon both the tort and the contract claims of the detailed license agreements between the joint ventures and Sovic, which actually licensed the technology. They were executed only 7 months after the joint venture agreements. They nowhere mention a cost pass-through, and they all contain integration clauses. With that roadmap, I'd like to turn to the statute of limitations. Now, that rule was critical since the pretrial fact record established that both Exxon and Mobil were on inquiry notice no later than 1994, which is well over 6 years before suit was filed. Just by way of example, Mr. Todd, an Exxon second deed to Kenya, and its chief accountant, based solely upon the reading of the Kenya license agreement, which was identical to the Yanpet license agreement, testified that the terms themselves made him suspicious that Sovic was charging a margin. And he wrote to his superior at Exxon in 1993, proposing that they discuss, quote, some details in the license that make me suspect we pay X per ton, whereas Sovic pays X minus the carbide, close quote. Later in 1994, Sovic sent to both Kenya and Yanpet Union Carbide's invoice to Sovic, which calculated the installment payments Sovic owed to Union Carbide and permitted Exxon and Mobil to calculate the exact amount of the alleged overcharge. And at the Kenya side, that resulted immediately in a blizzard of activity. Exxon secondee at Kenya, Mr. Fitzpatrick, reported to his superior at Exxon, Mr. Hendrick, that the invoice, quote, implied that the SABIC payment to Union Carbide was much less than the Kenya payment to SABIC, close quote. And by July of 1994, Exxon's appointees to the Kenya board had discussed the payment differential, and Hendrick, an Exxon executive, wrote in a note that there was, quote, reason to believe that Kenya pays about $6 million more per year than it should, close quote. And after all this, Exxon chose, apparently for business reasons, not to pursue the matter. Now, despite this and the other evidence in our brief showing that there was inquiry notice, the jury was not permitted to consider the statute of limitations by reason of the trial court's oral pretrial summary judgment ruling that, as a matter of law, there was no applicable statute of limitations. And that was simply error.
Mr. Sparks, could you refresh? Your client was the plaintiff below, right?
The client was the plaintiff below seeking declaratory relief that it was not liable on these overcharge claims.
Yeah, that's what I don't really get, which is I understand the policy purpose behind our borrowing statute. But it really doesn't make sense to me. You haven't challenged in your brief the notion that under Saudi, if this case had proceeded in Saudi Arabia, there really isn't a statute of limitations. Your client chooses and seeks out Delaware as a forum and sues somebody to get a declaration of non-liability. And then instead of being willing to fight that on the substantive ground, you say the reason we're not liable is because Delaware's statute of limitations has run.
We did plead in the declaratory judgment complaint the statute. And we're prepared.
But tell me the policy sense, because none of the relevant conduct here occurred in Delaware. Your client simply chose Delaware as the forum to have this battle and then says, aha, we don't win on substance. We win because the Delaware borrowing statute applies, and the shorter of the limitations period is Delaware, where nothing occurred, and therefore we win on technical grounds. I just don't understand why that isn't either an improper use of the declaratory judgment procedure or simply an implicit but very obvious waiver of the borrowing statute's protections.
Right. Number one, we didn't select this forum for any reason other than the fact that among fora in the United States, this was the only one where you could be sure you'd get these two subsidiaries. They weren't present in, for example, the New Jersey action. These are two Delaware corporations. We can sue them and get jurisdiction over them in Delaware. Number two, fully understood and understand that this would not preclude a decision on the borrowing statute and the statute of limitations grounds would not preclude the other side from going and suing in Saudi Arabia.
So you sued in Delaware to get a declaration that you couldn't be sued in Delaware?
And to get a determination on inquiry notice, which would be collateral estoppel in any other jurisdiction. It may or may not, depending on the length of the statute of limitations in another jurisdiction, result in the same result as Delaware. And we also, we sued, and one of our counts was a declaratory judgment that is barred by the statute of limitations. We also sued on the substance. So if we had not prevailed for whatever reason on the statute of limitations, the merits would have also been litigated here. In fact, they were. As we see, we submit that the trial court's decision is contrary to any number of both statutory mandates and case law mandates. The last sentence of the borrowing statute, section 8121, provides that where a cause of action accrues in favor of a person who is a resident of this state, the Delaware's limitations period shall apply. ECAI and Yanbu are Delaware residents. In Brosman versus FDIC, this court held that the last sentence of the statute means what it says, quote, the Delaware statute of limitations must apply. And as this court stated in PAC versus Beach Aircraft, and as reflected in the first sentence of 8121 itself, the clear purpose of 8121 and borrowing statutes generally is only to shorten the statute of limitations applicable to actions arising in foreign jurisdictions, not to lengthen it. Notwithstanding that, the trial court ruled, as Vice Chancellor Strine just observed, that the Delaware law required application of what she viewed to be a longer, eternal Saudi limitations period. And simply put, there's no basis in law for that. Directly contradicts the last sentence of 8121, the directly contradicts Brosnan, contradicts the court's command in PAC that 8121 is designed to shorten the time limit, not to extend it, and erroneously equated the Saudi analog of judge-made common law that property rights are eternal to the New Jersey wrongful death issue or statute that was at issue in the PAC case, which not only involved a shorter limitations rather than a longer limitations period, but also involved a statute with a built-in condition destroying the statutory cause of action itself if not commenced within a particular time. In other words, the PAC case is a case where the cause of action, by virtue of the action of the New Jersey legislature saying we're creating something that doesn't exist at common law, but we're putting a two-year limit on it, it was dead on arrival before it got here. And that has absolutely no application to the facts.
Mr. Spurge, help us focus for a minute. There were really two components of the trial court's ruling on the statute of limitations issue. The first was that to the extent there's a cause of action under Saudi law, there is no statute of limitations. And the second was that the borrowing statute as a policy matter should not apply in this case. I gather it's only the second ruling that's of concern to you.
It's the second ruling that's of concern, and it is, in effect, we submit the trial court sitting as a super legislature.
But there's a lot of talk in the briefs about whether the court should or shouldn't have determined that there was an eternal statute of limitations or no statute of limitations, but that's all irrelevant, isn't it? Because even if there is no statute of limitations, if your construction of the borrowing statute is correct, the claim is barred.
Correct.
So it's only the latter determination that's of relevance here. Is that right?
That's right. It's the latter determination that the refusal to apply the last sentence of the borrowing statute in a circumstance where the legislature has said it and has applied it.
Mr. Sparks, but how do you deal with the fact that the borrowing statutes, the plain words say that where a cause of action arises outside of the state, an action cannot be brought in a court of this state?
You're referring to Section 8117.
Yeah.
Yes.
Who brought the action here?
We brought the action, but the borrowing statute is key to the cause of action accruing to the resident. And as we pointed out in our briefs, 8117 has no application here. Under this court's decision in Hurwitz versus Adams, which is a 1959 decision, tolling under 8117 applies only if a person is not subject to personal or other service to compel his appearance. And SABIC has at all times, under 1608B of the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, been subject to service of process in Delaware. So
now, that's an argument that your side made for the first time in the reply brief. Is that right?
It was not a basis for the court's ruling below.
Is that right?
Excuse me?
That your side raised the argument under the FSIA for the first time in the reply brief.
Absolutely.
So we have essentially a one-sided argument with no ability of the other side to test whether or not, in fact, your client could be served under that statute.
No, the other side fully briefed 8117 in their answering brief, and we responded in our reply. And they raised it and characterized it as an additional grounds for affirmance.
And in their answering brief, they pointed out that your side, knowing that that was an issue below, made no reference to it and that they were concerned that they would be sandbagged in the reply brief.
We had no way of knowing it would be an issue on appeal. It wasn't reached by the court below. In fact, one would have thought that if the court below thought it had any merit, it would have reached it first because it would have disposed of the statute of limitations issue without having to struggle as the court did with PAC and all of the rest of the decisions. The court looked at it, obviously thought it was of no moment because it's very simply answered. The other side comes in and raises it as an additional grounds for affirmance in their answering brief, and we responded in our reply.
If 8117 applies, then the statute is told. That is, there is no more statute of limitations argument. Is that correct?
If 8117 were to apply, if we were not to have been, we were not to have been subject at all times to the service of process that the federal or the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act provides, then 8117 would have applied. That's right.
And if your side were to prevail on the limitations argument, which is couched as an affirmative claim in this lawsuit, what would be the import of it? That is, would it be a final judgment that the other side would not be entitled to sue in Delaware if they chose to do it, but would be free to sue someplace else?
They would be free to sue someplace else. We would certainly seek, with respect to any determinations with respect to inquiry notice on collateral estoppel basis, to export that to whatever jurisdiction it might be appropriate to do so. And if they're right that there's no internal or there's no statute of limitations in Saudi Arabia, it would have no application there. And in connection with some other state, it would depend on how long that other state statute of limitations was. If they had a 3-year statute, we would certainly argue that there was collateral estoppel on any issue having to do with inquiry notice in that other state, but they could still seek to bring they're subject to whatever other defenses we might have in those other states.
Mr. Sparks, I just because it might be I might be the only one it's important to, but to me I don't understand your answer about the first sentence of section 8121, the borrowing statute. It says where a cause of action arises outside of the state, an action cannot be brought in a court of the state to enforce such cause of action after the expiration of whichever is shorter, dot, dot, dot. Your client brought the action, not your opponents. So why isn't it just logical inference that the borrowing statute wasn't intended to provide opportunistic gains for declaratory judgment plaintiffs seeking declarations of non-liability?
Because first, the cause accrued, the cause of action accrued to ExxonMobil, and that's governed by the last sentence.
But
as to the second, I'm sorry.
Tell me what the meaning of the first sentence is then.
Well, the meaning of the first sentence has no direct application in these circumstances. But if you were to give application to that sentence, it's clear that it deals with the shorter statute of limitations, either applying.
So it's simply the second sentence that you believe applies?
Yes. Unless Your Honors have other questions, I'd like to turn to the second point. And that is the Bin Salama evidence. Now, as we point out in our briefs, there were a number of critical evidentiary rulings, and they were all exacerbated by the difficulty of trying a case based on the recollections of people, some dead, some alive, and lots with faded memories from 20 years ago. But the most crucial error of this sort was the rule prohibiting Mr. Bin Salama, SABIC's chief negotiator of the disputed agreements, from testifying that he had personally told his counterparts at ExxonMobil during the negotiation that SABIC would receive a margin on the technology. And that testimony, if accepted by the jury, would have rebutted that of Mr. Murphy, the only ExxonMobil witness who recalled a statement by SABIC during the negotiations that there would be a pass-through. And it would belie ExxonMobil's assertions to the jury that the so-called no-profit principle applied to technology required to manufacture polyethylene and that SABIC was, to use their words, secretly cheating its partners. Mr. Bin Salama is a former employee of SABIC, not in SABIC's control, who currently sits in the Saudi equivalent of the U.S. Senate. It was very difficult for us to reach, difficult for the other side to reach. And the substance of his prospective testimony on this point was made known to Exxon and Mobil in a declaration served on them as soon as SABIC learned of it, 4 months before trial. In short, there was no unfair surprise. Nevertheless, the trial court precluded his testimony as a form of discovery sanction based upon the theory that it was inconsistent with SABIC's prior discovery responses. And that was wrong both as a matter of fact and law. First, in prior discovery, SABIC, in its response to request for admission, and that's at B10-17 of the other side's appendix, and its witnesses in their 30B6 depositions had merely said truthfully, and before anyone learned of Bin Salama's specific testimony, that it and they did not know whether any SABIC employee had told ExxonMobil that SABIC was receiving a margin. As a legal matter, under Chancellor Allen's decision in Carlton versus Beatrice, which is the only Delaware case on point, a corporate entity is not required to inquire of former employees when preparing a 30B6 designee.
Mr. Sparks, I just want to be courteous enough to remind you that you have time for rebuttal that you've reserved. You can use your time now or continue to reserve it.
I think I'll go on for a few minutes, if I may. And remarkably, in his post-trial ruling, the trial court refused even to acknowledge the existence of Carlton. Under Carlton, nothing Sobeck did or didn't do amounted to the willful disregard of discovery rules required under our law to impose the sanction of witness preclusion, a civil death penalty, as Chief Justice Steele, back in his prior life on the Court of Chancery, mentioned in the Cantor Fitzgerald case. We submit that's a clear abuse of discretion and requires reversal. The last point I want to touch with and save, I will not get to the license agreement point, it does not appear, and I'll leave that to the briefs, is WSSIP. Under Saudi law, given the Islamic prohibition on the payment of interest, the only damage awardable for breach of contract is a return of the property taken. However, under the tort of WSSIP, enhanced damages are theoretically awardable in non-contract cases in unusual and compelling circumstances. The court's ruling on WSSIP was the product of three separate errors. Both Sobeck and the court's appointed expert opined that WSSIP is an open taking of property that not only deprives the plaintiff of property, but also shames or dishonors the plaintiff because he or his neighbors know about it. He doesn't have to know about it personally when it happens, but if his neighbors know about it, it shames him because he's powerless to stop it. The very reason that it's more severe is because of this shame factor. And contrary to the views of a majority of the Saudi law experts, and most importantly, Wilson, the trial court adopted the erroneous view of Exxon's expert that a secret taking could give rise to WSSIP, apparently failing to recognize that the term quar or quarian, which all the experts agree is part of the definition in the Hanbali text, excludes secret takings, and Wilson explains this at 2712 and elsewhere.
Mr. Sparks, what are we to do with the ruling of the court below, and I'm reading from page R54 of your opening brief. It says, contrary to the implication of Sobeck's briefing on this issue, the reality is that one cannot simply consult a statute book or a case reporter to find the elements of or damages available for the Saudi tort law of gossip. To illustrate the extreme difficulty of discerning and interpreting Saudi law, the court notes that none of the Saudi law experts who testified agreed on the proper elements of gossip. That's the right pronunciation.
Your Honor, I'm going to hand up something that may help answer that. I'm going to hand this to the clerk. This is a supplemental appendix with testimony from Mr. Halak. I've already given the other side some of it. Mr. Halak, their expert, testified that he didn't know whether Saudi law had evolved since 870 A.D. in terms of the definition of WSSIP or from the 17th century. Both of the other experts testified that the modern Saudi definition of quar excludes a taking. Notwithstanding that, the trial court below relied solely on the ancient text, contrary to what Rule 44.1 says, which is that you're supposed to rely on existing law. In the Islamic system, they don't have, as you, I'm sure you're here, they don't have a system of precedent like we do where they look at case law. But they do read these ancient texts and put present-day meaning on the terms of them. Indeed, even Mr. Halak recognized that in one of his statements in his deposition. Here the error was that the court got locked into 870 A.D., followed Halak, ignored her own expert. Also ignored Mr. Vogel and the ancient text in terms of the color of right point, which says that if you have any color of right, it's not WSSIP, as therefore you can't really have WSSIP in a contract circumstance if you have a colorable claim. And she ruled that the other side's position on the contract was ambiguous, and this court has already ruled in the cases cited in our papers that reasonableness means that it's at least colorful. So for all of those reasons, the WSSIP decision was inappropriate. Also, Sirmans and also federal due process make it clear that if you're going to give an instruction to a jury on something such as enhanced damages or any other point, you have to give them some guidance. And all this instruction said was you may or you may not award, in effect, an extra $324 million. I challenge your honors to read the last two post-trial opinions attached. You cannot read those and leave with any confidence that this RUSIP matter was handled in a way that was appropriate vis-a-vis this jury. It was simply given to the jury with no guidance, and the court sort of throws up its hands, indeed, on even the definition of RUSIP. I think if you go back through the record, as I have tried to do, and focus on the Halak testimony that I've just mentioned, you will see that was error. I don't know if this means I've used up all of my rebuttal time or if it means that I've just used up my 19 minutes.
What it means is you've made my first operation of the clock very simple by using all your time in your opening.
All right, well, I've then turned the podium over.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'd like to address a question from Chancellor Schrein with regard to the policy issue and the statute of limitations. One of the things that Mr. Spark said several times was, well, we need to apply the second sentence. Well, in fact, when PAC looked at the second sentence, PAC specifically said that the second sentence accepts certain classes of claims by Delaware residents, end quote, does not apply to a resident of Delaware suing on a foreign cause of action. And then went on to say, for policy reasons, you would apply rather regular conflict of laws, in this case, obviously applying conflicts of law, Saudi Arabia law would apply. And in those circumstances, if in fact the particular cause of action involved in the PAC case, it was a statute, a two-year statute of limitations. Here, clearly the eternal, I can't even say eternal statute of limitations because it's an oxymoron. There is no statute of limitations. It's the claim for property, and all of the experts agree, the claim for property in Saudi Arabia is one of the five fundamental rights in the Quran. And while that may be different in our country, that is, everyone agrees, a fundamental right. It is interwoven into the claim itself, the fact that it goes on forever. And under the PAC case, it's clear that under those circumstances, the borrowing statute simply is displaced. And when you also look at the policy that this court has set forth in the Chaplake Holdings case, which I think was only a couple of years ago, in that circumstance, this court said, we are willing to apply a procedural law from a foreign country, in that case it's the United Kingdom, on standing, I believe. We're willing to apply a procedural law if it's interwoven with the substantive law so that a party's rights are not impaired. And then taking a third case from this court, the Air Products case, there, the circumstances were very similar in a way to what happened here. Somebody ran in and got a DJ, or sought to get a DJ at the Superior Court level. The Superior Court said, wait a second, and the reason they did that was there was a three-year statute of limitations here and a 15-year statute of limitations in Puerto Rico. And the court said, wait a second, we're not going to let you stay here in Delaware if you're going to try to take away the rights of and everything that happened in Puerto Rico. We're not going to allow that to happen. It's essentially not fair. And what the Superior Court did here, Judge Jordan did here, is no different. She said it was fundamentally unfair for them to come into Delaware and to seek to take away our rights, whatever they may be, whether Delaware had absolutely nothing to do with this dispute. And she went on to say that it would turn the borrowing statute's intent, which was to prevent forum shopping, it would turn it on its head because it would reward foreign shopping.
So, do you agree with Mr. Sparks that there's no connection between the first and second sentences of Section 8121? Because I thought that the second sentence only applied if the first clause of the first sentence also applied.
Your Honor, frankly, it's not clear. I think the first sentence is basically intended to apply in a circumstance where a foreigner comes in here and tries to get a longer statute of limitations. So I think that was the intent, and that was what was meant. In the second sentence, I think that
about the clause that means where a cause of action arises outside of the state, an action cannot be brought in a court of the state to enforce blah blah blah.
Yes.
But that introductory language sets the stage for the remainder of
unless you have
a cause of action arising out of the state and an action to enforce that cause of action that's brought affirmatively, then 8121 doesn't apply.
I believe that is the intent of the statute. And I think that that's supplemented by the fact that if you look at how PAC ultimately, one of the things we were thinking about this, whether or not, because one of the arguments that Savick makes over and over again, well, the whole idea was we want to get a shorter statute of limitations. Well, if you think about the PAC case, I don't think there's any doubt that if the statute in New Jersey had been 10 years instead of 2, therefore it was longer, the PAC case would have applied to New Jersey statute because it was part of the substantive law of New Jersey. It wasn't a question of picking and choosing the shorter versus the longer. It was a question in that case as to what was the substantive law, was it intertwined with the claim. If you're doing a conflict of laws analysis and New Jersey law in that case applied, you would apply all of it, not just part of it. One of the things that we found of interest, and I think it's of interest here, as we were thinking about this and preparing, is that one of the issues, and Mr. Sparks mentioned this in this case, is whether or not we could get interest on our claim. And under Saudi law, you're not entitled to interest. And so, therefore, we didn't get interest. But the argument came up during the course of the case as to whether or not, for public policy reasons, since we were Delaware corporations, we should be entitled to get interest. And the Savick side argued this vigorously, that no, that was part of the substantive law of Saudi Arabia, and we were not allowed to pick and choose which parts of the law that they like and which parts of the law they don't like. Well, this is the very same circumstance with Savick now, seeking to pick that part that they like in Delaware and not that part that they don't like.
Do I take it, Mr. Quinn, that as far as your side is concerned, the limitations issue can be disposed of based on PAC's construction of the second sentence of the statute?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe.
Without regard to public policy
fairness. Yeah, I think that this court in the PAC circumstance, well, I think in a sense that the PAC was looking at public policy by saying that that they're not going to apply rigidly the borrowing statute in a circumstance where it's a Delaware resident who is suing on a foreign cause of action. Rather, they're going to look at the cause of action, where it occurred, and make a determination as to which statute appropriately should apply. And I think that also happened in the Damone case. And there's several other cases that we cite in our brief where the PAC rationale is, in fact, utilized and brings in a foreign statute. Now, in addition, with regard to 8117, putting aside the fact that they didn't raise it in their brief, and they certainly could have because they knew it was raised below, the reality is that reading that statute under any circumstances, it's an independent basis for tolling the statute of limitations. Savick had taken the position in New Jersey and all along until most recently that, in fact, they could not be sued under the FSIA until they filed the lawsuit in Delaware. Because it wasn't until they filed the lawsuit in Delaware that, in fact, under the language of 8117, they had come into the state. That statute doesn't simply mean if there's some way I can nail and mail or do some kind of service to process, that's all you need to do. It has to be process that's meaningful. If you look at the Brosnan case and the Petriolis Mexicanus case, both of those cases say that the service has to be such that you can get in personam jurisdiction. You can get a judgment that's enforceable in Delaware, not simply that you send somebody something in the mail and they may or may not show up. 8117 applies here, and it applies to Savick, and it applies to Savick specifically because they took the position throughout the New Jersey case and into this case that they were not subject to being served and therefore getting jurisdiction over them until they, in fact, came into Delaware.
Is your point that SABIC is judicially stopped from pretending otherwise?
Given their prior position. Now, let me speak for a moment with regard to the issue of Mr. Bin Salamat and whether or not that was error. First of all, as I understand it, under the in this circumstance, when we're talking about a matter of evidence, the other side has the burden of showing that there was significant prejudice here. Now, you have to step back and, having lived through this, understand what actually happened with Mr. Bin Salamat. What actually happened was, and the record is clear, and we've cited all this in the brief, for months they stonewalled us about this issue, and they told us that in their 30B6 depositions, in requests to admit, and in other depositions, that they had no knowledge that, in fact, anybody had ever told us about a increase or difference with regard to what they called a margin. And finally, after all discovery was closed and there was no depositions available, and in response to our motion for summary judgment on the contract issue, they, in fact, came up with a Salamat declaration which said he did now remember that he had, in fact, told a variety of dead people that there was, in fact, a margin.
Were they dead then?
I think two of the three of them were already dead.
And one, at the time he told them?
Yeah. Oh, that I'm not sure. I knew they were dead now. And so we obviously took the position that this was improper. But I think the most telling part of this whole story and why there's no substantial prejudice, and this is the part I was a little surprised that my colleague, Mr. Sparks, had forgotten, but Mr. Salamat did, in fact, testify. He testified to a whole bunch of things. One of the things he actually testified to was with regard to the second level of I hate to use the word cheating, it seems so unfair, but that's what happened. When they euchred us with regard to the releases back in 87, and they increased the actual, quote, margin, I asked him on the witness stand, well, did you tell anybody about this? And on the witness stand, he said, no, it was none of their business. And in the deposition that he gave 2 days before he got on the witness stand, this is what he said in answer to a question and answer. When asked in deposition, this is in footnote 35 of the brief, only days before his trial testimony, whether he, quote, ever told anyone from Mobile or from Exxon about SABIC's expected margin, close quote, Bin Salamat conceded, quote, we never talked about the margin. So it's really hard to see under those circumstances that there was any significant prejudice that would require a reversal of a jury verdict. Particularly in light of the fact the jury got to see Mr. Salamat and see him testify and see him actually tell all of us that it was the fact that they were overcharging us was, quote, none of our business. Now,
but is it not the case that there were witnesses, other witnesses, whose testimony arose after the discovery deadline who were allowed to testify at trial on your side? I believe your friends assert that in their briefs.
I don't recall that happening. I may be misremembering, but I believe when discovery ended, that there may have been some depositions that were taken after that because there was an agreement that if you were going to, in fact, that's why we took Salamat's deposition, that if you were going to call somebody that otherwise had not been deposed prior to trial, you could depose them prior to trial. But that, other than that, I don't believe there was any.
Was this gentleman, and rather than risk mispronouncing his name, I was calling this gentleman, was he the 30B6 witness on this issue?
No, somebody else is a 30B6 witness, but a fellow by the name of Dr. Pai. But Dr. Pai, prior to giving his final 30B6 testimony on this issue, spoke to Bin Salamat for 8 hours. And we asked Dr. Pai in his deposition, my colleague Mr. Lender did, whether or not this issue had ever come up, because he had the handwritten notes. And
when your friend said that this gentleman was the 30B6 witness for this particular issue and Mr. Pai was for other issues and you didn't bother to take his 30B6 deposition in that capacity, that's just not correct.
That is not correct. Dr. Pai was the 30B6 witness on the issue of what was told to Exxon and Mobil. Mr. Bin Salman didn't show up on the scene other than having a meeting with Dr. Pai so Dr. Pai could give his 30B6 testimony. He didn't show up on the scene until he gave this affidavit after all discovery was over. Which is why I believe that the Superior Court felt that there was a certain amount of sandbagging that was going on, at least by Savick, and I'm not in any way impugning the lawyers. I'm simply saying that I think that there were serious issues that the court felt strongly about that was put Exxon in a position where we couldn't rebut Bin Salman, one of the witnesses who they claimed, two of the witnesses, I believe, who they claimed he said who were dead, but a third one was out of the country, and we simply were not able to get his deposition to rebut the testimony. Now, let me talk for a moment, if I could, on the issue of, and I think it may be, we refer to it as usurpation, gossip or usurpation, because here I think the Savick has gone a long way to try to undermine the incredible work that was done by the Superior Court in trying to come up with what exactly were the right elements with regard to usurpation. And if you go back and you look at all of the decisions by Judge Jordan in this regard, and you look at all of the, there were 12 expert reports, including expert reports put in by Savick after the verdict. There were hundreds and hundreds of pages of testimony on these issues. Everyone agreed, all three of the experts agreed on a few basic things. One, that the Hanbali school was the actual law to be applied in Saudi Arabia. They all agreed with that. They also all agreed that with regard to the issue of whether or not you had to have open and notorious, or jar or jaran, which is the terms in the Sharia law, all of them agreed that the Hanbali school did not require that. All of them, Wilson, Vogel, and Halak. So what particularly Vogel, who Judge Jordan, having seen him testify, determined that was basically more of an advocate than an expert, his testimony kept changing. But what Vogel then did was go outside the applicable law. It was like, as the analogy somebody used, was it's as if the U.S. law applied that you go to France to see what they do. And it tried to import concepts from other schools in the Sharia law that simply didn't apply. And what, after going through and struggling through all the testimony and all the expert reports, what Judge Jordan did was use, as the term is, her ishtihad, that is, her broad discretion, which you are allowed to do under the Saudi law, and everybody agreed to this. Wilson agreed to it, Vogel agreed to it, Halak, all of the experts agreed that that is precisely what a judge sitting in as a Saudi judge would do in order to come together. One of the most interesting parts of all this, and we all learned a lot about Saudi law, but one of the most interesting parts about it was, and I think Vogel himself testified to it, their guy, that oftentimes the same judges on the same facts will in fact come out with different results. And it's just the nature of having a system that has no precedent, and it's the system that in fact exists under the Sharia law. Therefore, one other point on this issue of open and notorious. I asked Mr. Vogel during his deposition the following question. It's in the brief. I said, look, if I go up to Brazil and you come in and take my horse, and I'm in Brazil for a couple of years, but you go and take my horse, I have no idea you've taken my horse. And perhaps other people know, perhaps they don't, but I don't know. Would that be usurpation? Would that be robbery? He thought for a moment and said, yes. Well, under those circumstances, it's clear that you don't have to have knowledge. And he also conceded, in essence, that it was not necessary that it be, quote, open and notorious. And Wilson also agreed, the independent, that, in fact, under the Hanbali school, you don't need open and notorious. Now, and I know this is really arcane stuff, but Mr. Sparks raised it. Mr. Sparks said, well, but in the Hanbali school, there's a concept called gar. And that's true. But what Mr. Wolfson, the independent, testified to, along with Halak, is that that in the Hanbali school simply means without consent. Nothing more. And here, clearly, that was satisfied. The bottom line, I think, is that, and I think we've cited cases to this effect, that under these circumstances, particularly where the credibility of experts were involved, while obviously your review is a de novo review, we believe, should give deference to the trial court who heard all the evidence, listened to the experts, saw them be cross-examined, read through the depositions, appointed her own expert. I've tried lots of cases. I've never seen a more thorough, analytical job done by any judge to try to come to the right result. And in fact, one of the most interesting things asked of all the experts is, in the end, when you are exercising your ijtihad, what is it that a Saudi judge is supposed to do? And I believe from the witness stand, Mr. Wilson said, he or she is trying to do the right thing in the circumstances. Vogel agreed with that. Halak agreed with that. It's a different concept, but that, in fact, is what happened here. What Judge Jordan did is she took a look at all of the different underlying reports, and there was an endless amount of discussion, very technical. There was a lot of talk about goats and sheep and horses, because, in fact, in the text that matter in Sharia law, those are the kinds of examples that are used.
Well, how do you deal with the fact that, like, embezzlement, I thought all the experts concluded that something like embezzlement would not qualify as this tort, and that your expert, no one was able to cite any example close to this case where this serious tort was used.
To the latter, Your Honor, because there is no stare decisis, and therefore there's no place to go look for these. And whether or not in a particular circumstance in the 17th century or the 18th century something similar like this occurred, none of us will ever know. And what the judge decided is that with regard to, for example, when Mr. Wilson went to the kingdom and he had discussions with lawyers and I think a judge who didn't want to actually tell us his identity, she decided that that wasn't a proper study of what you're supposed to do in terms of actually analyzing the Saudi law. Rather, you have to go back to the original text and the original Saudi thinkers and look at what they say the elements are. And what she determined based on looking at those writings and the analysis of those writings by all of the experts, that in fact the elements of usurpation were those that she charged the jury with.
What about the question about lack of standards for determining whether to award the enhanced damages?
Your Honor, I think that's a very good question because I think that's a tad misleading. This was not a question of enhanced damages. What I mean by that is all of the experts agreed that under the tort of usurpation, you are entitled to get not only, and I'll use the analogies that are used, you're entitled to get back not only your goat, but the baby goat. And by that I mean they're very specific, and Vogel, of all people, actually said this, that the Hanbali school is extraordinarily tough about making sure that you get back not only your money, but any profits earned with regard to the money. So there were standards and those were the standards that were set down under the Saudi law, to which everybody agreed, and that's how the jury was charged on the issue. What's interesting here...
Wasn't the jury told that you may award these additional damages?
That's correct. And you may or may not.
Well, if it's as you say, then the jury should have been instructed, if you find Part A, you shall award this additional amount.
No, because I think under the Saudi law, it's not required that they be awarded. And the judge also added, in the context of the charges with regard to usurpation, that they had to find that what was done blatantly and recklessly, something that, frankly, probably raised the bar above what was necessary under the Hanbali school with regard to usurpation. I believe that the charges that Judge Jordan gave in these instances were clear. They weren't... they weren't misleading in any way, and I think the jury understood what they were supposed to do. One of the things that I think is important to understand is we were not allowed to even mention this issue until all of the evidence was in, because the judge wanted to make a determination herself that we had, in fact, reached an appropriate burden of proof that would allow this issue of usurpation to go to the jury.
Thank you, Mr. Clark.
Thank you.
I won't quibble about whether I spent your 8 seconds discussing the clock or not. You may have 8 seconds, Mr. Clark.
Sure, there's 3 points. I'll just do it from here.
That's fine.
One, not all dead. Mr. Tickler, one of the people that Mr. Bouchard was talking about, we know he wasn't dead, but appeared to justify the trial. Number two, I urge the court to read Appendix 2712 to 2716, Wolfson's testimony on Quar, saying it excludes a secret taking. And number three, there is, on the deposition of Mr. Bin Salama, what Mr. Bin Salama said was not that that there wasn't that they never discussed the margin. It was in the context of asking a question about the exact margin. And that's true. The exact margin was never discussed because Union Carbide wouldn't permit it to be discussed. But that's different from saying that you discussed the fact that we're taking the margin. That's all, Your Honor. Thank you.
I do want to make sure the record reflects that I discussed with counsel and with the court before the proceeding that Justice Holland would not be here today. He will be reviewing the tape. If that gives rise to any additional need to supplement the record in any way, we'll notify you. Otherwise, welcome to the interns from Potter Anderson today. You certainly had an interesting argument, and I expect you'll go discuss the Saudi terms on your way home today. Thank you very much for an excellent argument. We're in recess.
Thank you.